You had just witnessed two separate conversations occurring side by side.
Sounds like America 2016 to me.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on 93 FM WLRI News Radio. In Hawaii, on 88.5 FM KAKU, The Voice of Maui. In Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN 94.1 FM. In Palinville, New York, on 102.9 FM WLPP. And in Minneapolis, St. Paul, on the great AM 950 KTNF, The Progressive Voice of Minnesota. And yep, coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Well, we've got a big, big show for you after a big, big night. But first, I need to note that in 2008, some 6 million Americans were unable to vote because they didn't register to vote, either because they didn't know how or they missed a deadline. That, according to NationalVoterRegistrationDay.org. If you watched the big presidential debate on Monday night, let it be a great reminder. Today is a fantastic day to register to vote, or to make sure that your registration is up to date and or help someone else get registered today. Registration requirements are a bit different in each state, but you can find out how to do it in the state where you live or how to check your registration to make sure it's still active and up to date. Remember, some states like Ohio and Kansas and Georgia and others have been illegally purging voters from the rolls. So you can go over to vote.usa.gov from wherever you are, and they will help you out. Okay, well, Trump wreck. Last night's much-anticipated first presidential debate featuring Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as moderated by NBC's Lester Holt at Hofstra University in Long Island, New York, did not disappoint. It was quite the spectacle. Holt's chosen topics were said to be achieving prosperity, America's direction, and securing America, but I will be damned if I can tell you when one section ended and the other one began. The bar and the expectations for businessman and reality TV star Donald Trump were remarkably low going into the night, set that way by the corporate media and even by his own supporters. Trump surrogate Newt Gingrich, for example, tweeted just before the debate, "Donald Trump will pass the test of being adequately competent and will get a big boost in acceptability." Adequately competent? That's it. That's all we're expecting from a commander-in-chief and the leader of the supposed free world? Well, apparently he didn't seem to even do adequately competently, according to the early reviews, as CNN, yes, even CNN writes today, Trump's tenuous relationship with the truth was remarkable. He said he was against the Iraq war. He wasn't. That Clinton's camp started the birther movement. It didn't. That stop and frisk wasn't ruled unconstitutional. It was. And then they add, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nate Silver said immediately afterwards, "Good news for Democrats. Hard to see how that debate helped Trump. 18 out of 20 undecided voters in CNN's focus group right after the debate thought Clinton won it. 16 out of 21 on Fox News thought Clinton won it." CNN's snap poll of debate watchers immediately afterwards, which they admitted was skewed to debate watchers only, who they found to be more Democratic than Republican. In any event, according to that poll, Clinton won the debate over Trump 62 to 27%. That would be a thumping, as George W. Bush might have said in his day on foreign policy. They saw Clinton beating Trump in the debate 62% to 35%, though on the economy. Clinton did beat Trump in this poll, but only by 4 points. Surprisingly close, particularly given the Democratic weighting of that particular survey. PPP's post-debate survey also found similar numbers. Hillary Clinton defeating Donald Trump in the debate 51 to 40%, according to PPP. That's an 11-point thumping. Among young voters, Clinton, who has been underperforming with them, yet PPP found that 63% think she won the debate, only 24% for Trump. 47% of voters in that age group thought that the debate made them more likely to vote for her, while Trump, for his part, only 23% said that the debate made them more, among young voters, made them more likely to vote for him. For Trump's campaign's part, they're citing a number of online polls finding that he was the winner by huge numbers. But those types of polls that they were citing, there were online polls. They're generally won by those with the biggest email and Facebook lists, pointing supporters to vote in those polls online. So they don't really mean much of anything. During the debate, even many conservatives were grudgingly conceding that Clinton was winning big time. Right-wing blogger Eric Erickson said, "Damn it, people. Marco would have been mopping the floor with Clinton. Ted would, Jeb would. But this?" Daily Wire's Ben Shapiro said IRS question totally threw Trump off his game and he never recovered. Former Breitbart editor John Nolte said Trump blew opportunities, too defensive, explained too much, should have ignored, bait, hit her on Benghazi, server, etc. Good luck with that. Let's see. I got a couple more here. Even, Trump's own surrogates here admitted that the debate was a disaster for him. Former mayor, New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani said, "If I were Donald Trump, I wouldn't participate in another debate unless I was promised that the journalists would act like journalists and not an incorrect, ignorant fact checker." Conservatives National Review's David French wrote, "I felt like I was watching the political Titanic hit the iceberg, back up, and hit it again just for fun." Strangest reaction of the night, by the way, might have been from the Lawrence, Kansas Police Department, who put out a tweet with this reminder, in all caps, "We realize politics can make emotions run high, but being mad at a presidential candidate in a debate is not a reason to call 911. Yes, they actually said that. So there was a whole bunch of debates, topics that they covered at the debate, though I'll tell you, for Lester Holt, for his part and his credit, I would argue, largely set back and let the two candidates go at it, revealing a lot about themselves, frankly, rather than their positions. For my part, I think Clinton destroyed Donald Trump last night, or at least he destroyed himself. Either way, I think it was a disastrous night for Trump. I've been watching these debates for a long time, and I don't think I have ever seen anything that was so decisive, in truth. Usually partisans will find something they like and they claim their candidate won or it was a draw. But I thought this was more one-sided than I have ever seen in a presidential debate. That said, President Reagan in 84 and President Obama in 2012, they were also pretty universally seen as having lost their first debate. And both candidates turned that around in subsequent matchups. So with those opinions from the right, a few of my own, let's get a bit more of the progressive perspective on what the hell happened at the first presidential debate on Monday night. Three of my favorite folks who have watched a lot of these debates as well are here with us. First, of course, our own Desi Doyen is here as usual. How are you doing, Desi Doyen?
Yeah,
are you surviving?
I'm tired, but all right.
Yeah, I know. You did a hell of a job, not just surviving the heat out here in California, but surviving that debate and figuring out how to cut quotes from it, that was no easy feat, given
Tell
what
me
we.
About it.
Yeah, given what we. I mean, it was just insane.
Word salad.
Trump was all over the map. Rarely a completed thought or a sentence before moving on to something else. Anyway, thank you for that and for being here. I'm also happy to welcome back our reigning champion. I think she was with us for more primary debates than anyone else, I'm fairly certain. Heather Digby Parton, known as simply Digby to many. She's the creator of the infamous Hullabaloo blog, a regular contributor at Salon.com, and 2014's Hillman Prize winner for opinion and analysis journalism. Oh, Heather, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Always great to have you with us, especially on days like this. Also joining us today, no slouch himself, our old friend David Dayan, financial journalist, contributing columnist at Salon, Fiscal Times, New Republic, The Intercept, The American Prospect, and everywhere else. He's also the author of the important new book, Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hey, David, welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, it was an amazing night. Heather, Trump's behavior, it seemed to me, during the debate seemed to underscore everything that the Clinton campaign has been charging about him and his temperament. He couldn't help himself. He took the bait. Every single time, though that seemed really easy, you know, the bait that Clinton had set out for him. Your broad thoughts, we'll get into the specifics in a bit here, but just your broad thoughts on what the hell happened last night.
Well, I agree with you about the fact that I think she really, she dominated the debate. I think it was clear who was in control and who wasn't. She would throw out, you know, she would thrust and he would parry, and I'm sure that made him very, very uncomfortable, being the major macho dude that he is. And that's probably part of what was the problem. I mean, she was the one who was in control, and he could not grab it back. On the day yesterday in the morning, I had written my daily column for Salon, and I had gone back and looked at all the primary debates, which you and I talked about at length over all those months.
Yeah.
And in the early days, he had sort of established a kind of a class cut-up position in the lineup there. There were so many of them, and he would just come in. He would really do a jab, something really crude and cruel, and kind of establish his dominance that way. But I noticed that as time went on and the field narrowed, and by the time he got to the very end, and there were just four of them, there was Kasich, Rubio, and Cruz. Trump was much less effective. He was, by that point, really rambling and incoherent. They all had much more time to answer questions. And I don't know if you recall, the very last debate was the serious debate. You know, everybody's going, they've really calmed down. We're really hearing about the issues now. This is really, you know, this is it, folks. This is where we're really going to get the information. He was babbling like Sarah Palin through that whole thing. And I went back and looked at it, and I went, if it's true, and I wasn't sure that it was, but I was fairly confident that it was true, the one true thing the Trump campaign has ever said, which was that he was not preparing. And if that was the case, I was kind of thinking this was going to happen last night, because he has, not only does he not prepare, he has demonstrated throughout this campaign, from the very beginning, that he has no underlying knowledge of basic facts, issues, substance that I think even just a college freshman running for office would have.
Yeah.
And he is simply uninformed, and he's intellectually about as ill-prepared, I think, as anyone I've ever seen running for higher office. And that includes not even higher office, even Congress or some kind of local school board. He is, he's been running this whole thing by the seat of his pants from the very beginning, and he has good political instincts. I'll give him credit. You know, it's not, he didn't get here, by sheer luck. I mean, there's a reason for it. But when he is exposed as having to speak for longer than a few minutes with a quick soundbite or some kind of a personal retort or something about himself or his poll numbers or that sort of thing, when he actually has to directly address an issue, he literally cannot do it. And I would even argue that the big issue that he was given credit for last night, the trade issue, that he was not particularly coherent on that either. There were plenty of errors in that. It's just that he sounded more confident, and he had her a little bit on her heels. Not really, but it was the closest he came to actually landing a blow.
Yeah,
and he just is simply, look, I'm sorry, I know it's not politic to say this. he's an ignoramus when it comes to policy. And I think that showed last night, and I think that she basically just mopped the floor with
it. It seems like the only reason people are regarding the early part of the debate as, oh, he did well there, was because he did so poorly as the debate went on. And so the bar got lower and lower, and it's like, well, he didn't suck at the beginning. David Dayen, as noted, you know, I'm no Hillary Clinton fan, but I don't remember seeing another debate that was as clear of a mismatch as this one was. There was a lot of talk before the debate about the bar being lowered for Trump by the media and really by the public, by all of us, you know, that if he didn't, you know, do something stupid or punch Hillary in the face, that would be a win for Donald Trump. I don't even think he met that low bar. As noted, I think he was a disaster. Your very broad general thoughts in that regard.
Yeah, I think that there were two debates, and I don't want to say that in the context like I'm, you know, parroting some conventional wisdom about Trump did well and then he didn't do well. No, what I mean by that is the first half hour, and why I think it's been caught up into this thing where it was more of a contested race, is that the first half hour could have been two candidates running for state legislature in some district in North Carolina, in a swing district. That was the Republican mainstream vision versus the Democratic mainstream vision. It was really almost kind of a departure. You know, I mean, Clinton has been very much on you know, going after Trump for character issues, for his particular comments against women, comments on Muslim Americans, on Hispanics. This was about tax policy. It was about regulations. It was about trickle down economics, what she called trumped up trickle down. This is the kind of debate that we are accustomed to at a top level of Democratic politics and politics in general.
Small d Democratic
in
politics.
In the sense that was, you know, something where Trump flashed well or whatever, I mean, or what have you. I think it's just because it was more familiar.
Right.
Where it became unfamiliar is in the last hour of debate, where Trump kind of seemed like the guy that police would come upon in the woods standing over a body holding a shovel in his hand. There was just this extreme amount of backpedaling and explaining frantically going on that I think made everybody uncomfortable.
Well, let me before we get to the part with the guy in the wood with the shovel, let me stick to the well, the
which was the Republican Party, if you want to have a metaphor that
the person.
Yeah, you're right. but yet, David, the CNN poll, which was heavily weighted towards Democrats, still found that Clinton only beat him on the issue of economy, 51-47, 4 points. That seems surprisingly close.
Because it was a standard D versus R debate, at least for part of it. And Trump made the point trying to sever Clinton from the president on the issue of the TPP, which was could have been effective if it was followed on. But what's interesting is where Clinton made the turn. And I actually wrote about this for the Fiscal Times today. Where she made the turn is by looking at the specific instances of Trump as a businessman and really took that and put it in the position of the common sort of conservative argument that government should be run by a business, and saying here's the logical extension of that is that you get a government run by a businessman of the likes of Trump that cheats creditors, that files bankruptcy, that takes advantage of people, that takes advantage of loopholes, and that really undermines the sort of structure of fairness and the ability for the little guy to get ahead.
Look,
and that was an important moment, and it wasn't just an important moment for this debate. And we can talk about that.
Yeah, let's get into some of those specifics in a moment. I'm going to have to take a break here shortly. But, Heather, real quickly, I need to fess up here. I thought that Lester Holt was going to get steamrolled by Trump. And by the way, I thought the same thing might be true for Hillary Clinton, particularly due to that low bar I've discussed. Holt didn't get steamrolled. In fact, I appreciated the fact that he sat back and let them go after each other. And that's somewhat, as I understand it, Trump's own fault, because he reportedly wouldn't agree on rules for time that they usually have in advance. Your thoughts on that, and on Lester Holt's tactics there, whether they were carried out on purpose or not by him?
Well, I didn't know that he had not agreed to restraints on time. That was a big mistake, because normally, and it drives me crazy too, because when you're watching these things, it's like ding, 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 and you're okay, all right, you know, interrupting. It's very annoying. I really liked this format of them being allowed to just kind of, and they went back and forth, and yes, he interrupted her, but you know what, that's all right. She's a big girl. I'm sure she's used to being interrupted by obnoxious men. You know, we all got to see that she can handle that without losing her cool or bursting into tears. So, you know, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And, I felt like that was really good. And he actually, I mean, I thought he was very, Holt, I was very impressed. I mean, I thought that his questions were good, and I thought that his follow-ups, and he didn't, you know, aggressively, do one of those gotcha things. Well, now let me tell you, let me quote you from 1978 saying blah, blah, blah. It was more like, no, that's actually not true. You said this, blah, what we're talking about here is racial healing, I think was the term he used. So, you know, how do you explain this? And I thought he did a good job, and I thought he let both of them, they got to exchange. You know, it was an exchange between the two candidates, and I really hope the rest of them do this. I hate this time thing, I didn't know it was Trump, but it was a mistake on his part to do that, if that's the case, because I think it worked in her favor.
Yeah, and not just that it worked in her favor, but that we got to see them for who they are, seemingly. On the other hand, Jeff McCall, a professor of communications at DePauw University, said he felt it was not a good night for Lester Holt. He said he allowed the candidates to walk all over him. He lost control early on, and never got it back, that he appeared to challenge Trump more than Clinton. Before we go to the break here, David Dayan, Lester Holt did in fact check Trump, fact check him on taxes, on Iraq, on stop and frisk. He didn't do the same for Hillary Clinton. I think that's because she didn't lie as much as he did. But let me give you a chance, David, fact check here real quick. We'll have some specifics after the break. But is there anything that jumped out at you from Hillary Clinton that you feel should have been live fact checked last night by either Holt or Trump that she was able to get away with and should have been called out on, as you saw it?
I'm not sure if there's anything leaps to mind about that. I mean, there, aside from my own personal bugaboos when she said there were 5 million people who lost their homes, it's actually closer to 9, but that's just me talking. that would just be a fact check for me.
Well, what's 4 million lost homes between friends?
I haven't really been connected to the chatter online today for a variety of reasons, but I was expecting a lot of whining coming from the right.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that there was no immigration section, no question at all, when that issue, at least on the Republican side, has dominated the entire election almost to the exclusion of most other issues. The fact that there was no, not that I was really hoping for another rehash of Benghazi or emails or anything, but there was no question on that. I thought that there would be some ref working in a serious way today from the right, and I'm not sure if that has happened or not. And we'll see how that plays out. You know, down the road we have Chris Wallace that's going to be one of the moderators. I think it's Anderson Cooper, perhaps.
Yeah, Anderson Cooper.
In the other one?
Yeah.
Martha Raddatz, I think.
And Martha Raddatz together,
I think.
Yeah.
I think there are actually two moderators.
Yeah.
We'll see how they react because I do think that now the way in which these debates have been built up, the way in which the pre-gaming has almost overtaken the spectacle, and it's not really responsible, I think, in many ways, but the way that both sides sort of yell and scream about these things prior to the event kind of dictates where the event goes, at least to a minor degree.
And to be fair, there has been whining about the lack of immigration conversation, but also lack of discussion on the environment, health care, the Supreme Court, poverty, abortion rights, student debt, privacy. Right, exactly. Broken campaign finance system, voting rights, drug policy, all of that. There's only so much time, I guess, particularly if you want to let these guys actually talk to each other. As Lester Holt did. Let's hold it there for a second. Sit tight. Let me take a quick break, and we will come back with we'll get into some of these specifics in this amazing debate last night. We're with my guests, David Dayan and Heather Digby Parton, and of course Desi Doyen, and myself, Brad Friedman, right here on the broadcast. Don't touch that dial.
I will release my tax returns against my lawyer's wishes when she releases her 33,000 emails that have been deleted.
Well, I think you've just seen another example of bait and switch here. We know the IRS has made clear there is no prohibition on releasing it when you're under audit. So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? Maybe he's not as rich as he says he is. Maybe he's not as charitable as he claims to be. We don't know all of his business dealings, or maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen, he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes me smart. You don't learn that much from tax returns, that I can tell you.
Because I'm the tax man. Yeah.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, our special presidential debate coverage today, writing about the Clinton-Trump debate on Monday night. The GOP candidates needed to convince women to vote for him, says roll call columnist Walter Shapiro. He wrote that Trump seemed to be debating with the single-minded goal of turning his gender gap into a canyon. In 1973, a trash-talking, overage, self-described chauvinist pig named Bobby Riggs took on Billie Jean King in a tennis match in the Houston Astrodome that was billed as the Battle of the Sexes. King won in straight sets. History repeated itself Monday. Clinton defeated Trump in straight sets, says Walter Shapiro, with a very good reminder for those old enough to remember that Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King match. Donald Trump really is the Bobby Riggs of politics this year. My guests are David Dayan, of course, of the Fiscal Times, and Heather Digby Parton of Salon.com. David, you heard the exchange there at the top about Trump and his taxes. She called him out on releasing them again. Dan Senor, the former Bush administration official and Mitt Romney advisor, said Clinton did something tonight that no journalist has been able to do, surgically take him apart on his tax returns. And she explained why it matters. So why does it matter, David Dayan? What can we tell from his taxes that we can't see from his campaign disclosure? He kept pointing people to his FEC, his Federal Election Campaign Commission campaign disclosures. What can we see from his taxes that we cannot see from these FEC disclosures he keeps pointing to?
Well, I think it's about more than just the taxes. And she brought in really a host of issues last night, from taxes to bankruptcies to, you know, shortchanging employees who do work for him and then don't get paid. This was all of a piece to really position him on what's supposed to be this great strength, that he's a businessman and he can get government in shape and make great deals for the American people. She really showed the bankruptcy of that entire argument, and what's really interesting,
pun intended, I suspect.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is that Trump didn't deny it.
Right.
I mean, you heard in that clip after she said, well, maybe he didn't pay any federal income tax because in these 2 years he didn't pay any, he said, that makes me smart. I mean, his whole idea is, yes, I'm going to weaponize government and put it to use for America in some sort of form of economic nationalism. And Clinton's argument, and I don't think this would have come up if it was any other opponent, was that, you know, government shouldn't just be run like a business. And that is really important because these events every 4 years are really the only time that the entire country, or at least the entire part of the country that's interested in politics, gets together and watches the same thing and sees both sides mm-hmm. of the argument. And for Clinton in this public forum, this was not the reinventing government Clintons. This was not the era of big government is over Clintons. This was someone who said, you know what, sometimes these business experience doesn't transfer over into the office of the chief executive. And I think that's a really important concept for the public to have heard last night. And I hope it has a resonance that goes well beyond this election and starts to get at the core ideological differences between the parties, because it's something that Democrats don't often say, and they certainly don't say it enough.
Well, they don't, and yet I'm not sure that is going to be the message that is heard. I think people are focusing on the personal issues. Did he pay his taxes and things like that? Let me play this clip. They were talking about, it was hard to figure out what they were talking about because they were going from one thing to another. He was going from one thing to another, couldn't finish a sentence. But here is Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Trump is saying that our infrastructure is a disaster. This after years of Obama trying to, you know, pass an infrastructure bill. And then he gave this admission that, it seems kind of extraordinary.
Our airports are like from a third world country. And we're a mess. We're a debtor nation. We're a serious debtor nation. And we have a country that needs new roads, new tunnels, new bridges, new airports, new schools, new hospitals. And we don't have the money because it's been squandered on so many of your ideas.
But you responded,
maybe because you haven't paid any federal income tax for a lot of years. And the other thing I think is important.
It would be squandered too, believe me.
So... He didn't deny it. He said it would be squandered too had I paid it. Yeah,
that is the point. He said, "I work the system to my benefit, and if you elect me, I'm going to work the system to your benefit. But why should we believe that if the only person he's ever cared about, by his business record, is himself? And by extension, that is sort of the corporate mentality Clinton was." Trying to attack.
Heather, did you hear it as Trump admitting that he doesn't pay any federal income taxes there?
He said, you know, well, I'm smart. And I think that is an admission. I agree with David on this. I think that she did make an important argument there. And I think one of the things that people have to kind of realize, and I don't know how many people heard it specifically in terms of him, but making this kind of argument that when, you know, with Trump, it's all kind of a, you know, l'état c'est moi thing, you know, I am the state. When he says, I'm going to make America great again, what he's saying, and he said it later when he's talking about how they're going to bring billions back and create jobs and do all that stuff, that's the Romney plutocrat argument, which mm-hmm. Trump is getting away with, you know, kind of papering over with his talk about trade. His argument is that I am going to make our billionaires even richer than they already are, our American billionaires, and they're going to spend their money, and then they're going to, you know, they're going to create jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's Mitt Romney. He never sees workers as anything more than a statistic on some kind of a spreadsheet that shows where America is in the world, in his view, the best GDP, or, you know, we're number one. That's making America great again. He never talks specifics about how, you know, some, you know, workers are going to benefit from this. And to the extent that he does, He has said very explicitly in the past that, you know, wages are going to have to come down. He has said that what he wants to do, we won't be shipping jobs overseas, we'll be shipping them to different states. And in other states where they can pay less, then the workers in the original states may have to lower their wages in order to compete. I mean, this is, you know, it's a nationalist argument. It's not really a populist argument. And it's easy to confuse those things because they're often kind of, you know, there's a lot of tentacles in both of those arguments that sort of reach into the other. But his focus is nationalism, and that appeals to a lot of the same people, by the way. It's not, you know, they feel a loss of pride and status, and, you know, America isn't what it used to be, and damn it, you know, we ran the world and now we don't. But that is what she was kind of getting at, and basically trying to tie him to the Republican Party. In fact, let me quote something that Robert Costa said on MSNBC last night. And he's got great contacts in the Republican Party, and yeah. I think he saw this in a way maybe from that perspective that was interesting. She said she yanked him toward the Republican Party. You're not going to be able to run as an outsider. You can't be a populist. You're just like George W. Bush. You're trickle down economics like Ronald Reagan. You're supply side trumped up economics. This is a candidate whose real appeal is that he's non ideological, that he's not running as a partisan Mitt Romney, George W. Bush Republican, and she said, "I'm not going to let you do that." Mm. And I thought that was an interesting insight.
That was really interesting and different, because what we know, and BuzzFeed had a story on this, and we've seen it throughout the campaign. She has put him on the other side of the Republican Party. She has said he is too extreme for the Republican Party. There are ads with Lindsey Graham and Susan Collins and all of these Republicans saying, "I can't stomach Trump. I can't vote for Trump." She has, and this, by the way, Democrats in the House and Senate are not happy with this, because they're trying to tie their opponents to Donald Trump. And here's the top of the ticket who's saying, "No, this guy is totally on another plane, another wavelength. This is not the Republican you've seen before." And this is a play to try to get Republicans, not. It's not a policy play, but it's a play sort of to character, to try to bring some Republicans, wayward Republicans, along to vote for her. What it does for the party is something else. But she changed that last night. She really did put him in that position of a 1% plutocrat who wants to give corporations and the wealthy a giant break. This whole repatriation thing, I just want to briefly touch on that.
Yeah.
This is amnesty. This is corporations overseas have trillions of dollars stashed away because they don't want to pay taxes on it. And what he wants to do is allow them to bring it back and give them a huge tax cut, something on the order of paying 6% on the money rather than the 35% they actually would. In order to bring back the money. And what we know, because we've done this before, and even George W. Bush has admitted that it did not work, is none of that money goes to investment. It all goes to dividends. It all goes to stock buybacks. It goes into the pockets of shareholders and the wealthy executives in these companies. That is amnesty. That is what he's proposing. The signature proposal in that entire debate was a massive tax amnesty for the largest corporations in this country.
Let me,
and that needs to be hit home a little harder.
Let me,
and by the way, Chuck Schumer's for it too, and Clinton's not necessarily against it.
No, so I know
this is a bipartisan problem.
You're absolutely right. And I should note, by the way, David, because you said that it put some of this sort of business Republicanism on display. Clinton said Donald was one of the people who rooted for the housing crisis.
Right.
Trump jumped in and said, "That's called business." You wrote a book, obviously, about the housing crisis, and to see him coming out and admitting as much, that he was rooting for the housing market to crash because he hoped he made money on it. You're right. That seems like it must have resonance somewhere, but
it shows the pitfalls of being of weaponizing government, of treating government like it's a business where you can take advantage of other people.
All right, well,
people recoil from that.
Well, speaking of weaponizing business and government. How Donald Trump made this leap in the middle of this conversation that's a little bit incoherent. My apologies in advance. But let me play. They're talking about taxes. And suddenly, before you know it, we're at ISIS.
And people who have looked at both of our plans have concluded that mine would create 10 million jobs and yours would lose us 3.5 million jobs.
You are going to approve one of the biggest tax increases in history. You are going to drive business out. Your regulations are a disaster and you're going to increase regulations all over the place. And by the way, my tax cut is the biggest since Ronald Reagan. I'm very proud of it. I'm going to cut regulations, but I'm going to cut taxes big league, and you're going to raise taxes big league.
And not you'll see. Add a penny to the debt, and your plans would add $5 trillion to the debt.
You take a look at her website.
She's going to raise taxes $1.3 trillion.
Mr. Trump,
look at her website. She's telling us how to fight ISIS. Just go to her website. She tells you how to fight ISIS on her website. I don't think General Douglas MacArthur would like that
The next segment, we're continuing the subject of
ISIS. Well, at least I have a plan to fight ISIS.
Prosperity.
No, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
No, we're not.
See, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do. No wonder you've been fighting ISIS your entire adult life.
Okay. Now, We cut that for time, but we didn't cut that by much. He really went straight to ISIS out of taxes and regulations and national debt and so forth. Some of our cuts actually do him a favor, I think, by trying to make sense of what it was that he was actually saying. Heather, you got anything? Who wants that one?
I'll take it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, what the heck? I can't speak for the way, thoughts travel through that man's mind. It's obviously he's all over. It's like what I think happened there was that she mentioned website, and he then thought of, she has plans to defeat ISIS. She's got battle plans on her side to defeat ISIS or something. And then, of course, the minute he says ISIS or fight or anything like that, then for some unknown reason, the long-dead General MacArthur comes up, when it's not General Patton or, God forbid, Blackjack Pershing from the Spanish-American War, where he does the thing with the pig's blood, the bullets dipped in pig's blood, and mass murdering a bunch of Muslims in the Philippines. This is the way his mind works. I can't really speak for it, but his idea there, if we want to just pivot a little bit to the foreign policy side of this, he literally seems to believe that America can have no public foreign policy or national security posture. We can't say anything about that. We can't let anyone in the world know what our positions are, our values, what we think, what we should do, because if we do, the enemy is going to find out about it, and then they're going to counter, whatever we're going to move. It's the most puerile, juvenile approach that I've ever heard.
Convenient. I mean, it's like Nixon's secret plan to end the war.
Of course, it's idiotic.
He doesn't have to say anything because he doesn't have anything to say.
Of course. Well, he does. He has said, let's be fair, he has said that he would take the oil.
Oh, that's true.
That's his big thing. He would take the oil. We don't know what's entailed in that or, what he thinks. He has said at different times that he would put some... He would have some groups. He'd have a group guarding it. I think
really
that group is normally
the
called.
Out at once, yeah. By the way, they've been pumping oil for like 40 years.
That's right. We're going to get it out of there.
But the oil is
bring
a
it home.
Elongated process.
But his plan.
We're
going to remove it all, and we're going to bring it home, and then we'll be done with those people once and for all.
I got to get to a break. I think he's just going to send a great big straw down from space and pull it
and
out.
And drink your milkshake?
That's right.
Well, actually, and I should point out, because I keep having to point this out, he likes to pretend like, when I was asked by Howard Stern, I didn't really, I was just sort of asked. I just kind of lightly answered. But he still persists in the idea that he can take the oil, and that's a violation of the Geneva Convention.
Oh,
I mean, flat out violation of international law.
How quaint, Desi Doyen. let me take a quick break, and we'll be back with more on that. The Iraq War coming up. His judgment, his temperament, maybe some race. We'll see what we have time for in our last few minutes. Stand by. We'll be back with the broadcast and David Dayen and Heather Digby Parton and Desi Doyen. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away.
Well, I have much better judgment than she does. There's no question about that. I also have a much better temperament than she has. You know, I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament.
I came in like a wrecking ball. I never hit so hard in love. All I wanted was to break you up.
Welcome back to the broadcast, our special broadcast coverage of the first presidential debate of 2016 up in New York on Monday night with my guests Heather Digby Parton and David Dayen. All right, let's actually play a little bit more of that, and then I'll get comments from both of you guys on this. His temperament, the Iraq War, and everything else all built into this one clip.
Donald supported the invasion of Iraq.
Wrong.
That is absolutely
wrong.
Proved over and over again.
Wrong.
You had supported the war in Iraq before the invasion. What makes your judgment?
I did not support the war in Iraq.
2002.
That is a mainstream media nonsense put out by her.
Since you
would you like to hear?
It, why is your
I was
why
against
is your
the war. Wait a minute. I was against the war in Iraq. When I did an interview with Howard Stern, I said very lightly, I don't know, maybe, who knows. I then spoke to Sean Hannity, which everybody refuses to call Sean Hannity. If somebody would call up Sean Hannity, this was before the war started.
Question was, why is your judgment any different than Mrs. Clinton?
Well, I have much better judgment than she does. There's no question about that. I also have a much better temperament than she has. You know, I have a much better, I think my strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament.
Secretary Clinton.
Woo! Okay.
Okay. Audible laughter in the at Hofstra University. There, they literally laughed out loud when he's talking about how great his judgment and temperament is, while he's turning red in the face. Heather Digby Parton, you have the floor.
Well, I mean, you saw how the audience reacted. I mean, especially after the performance that he had just put on. It was absurd, but it's interesting because he's done this throughout the entire campaign. He does do one thing. He can't study an issue for, you know, obviously he has no ability to actually learn anything about substance, but he does study polls, and in the polls it shows that her temperament is considered to be better than his, and his common reaction to anything like that is to just basically say the opposite. No, my temperament is better than hers. It's the you can believe me or you can believe your lion eyes and, you know, strategy. And it apparently works for him with people who are voting for him. I find it a little bizarre that people would actually fall for that, but they seem to. Essentially, he just, you know, I think he's a politician with good instincts about certain things. And the fact that he will stand there and just assert boldly something that is patently and obviously absurd and stand there and do it, I think there are people who are impressed by that. It is, you know, it's a ballsy move to do that. Okay. And he did it, and I don't think he won the day last night. It was obvious because he behaved like a petulant child through most of the debate, but I think that it has been something that actually has worked for him.
You say petulant child, like that's a bad thing. That's what that's what got him here. Desi Doyen,
when you said that, Heather, that made me think, you know, he's really good. We all know he's really good at working the room, at reading the room, and telling the people what they want to hear in most cases. And perhaps maybe that's why he had trouble finding his footing, not only being knocked off by Hillary Clinton and in a number of ways by being dominated by her, but also it's really hard to read a room when there's no reaction.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Which was not allowed, it wasn't supposed to be allowed, as it was during the primary races. Huffington Post's Howard Fineman said that Donald Trump turned in the worst, and I mean worst, debate performance in modern times. It was so bad that in a normal year, it would disqualify him from getting anywhere near the White House. But this is 2016, a year so weird, unsettled, and unsettling that even the spectacle of an unprepared and almost incoherent Trump reeling from blow after blow from Clinton may not be enough to slow him down. Heather, well, actually, let me take this to David. David, does the needle move here after a night like we saw at Hofstra University on Monday?
Oh, geez, I don't know. I mean, I've developed an allergy to predicting where this race
well,
is going to
well,
go.
Well, let me put it.
I really have no idea.
Well, let me put it this way, David. Is there a danger in for Clinton and for her supporters getting sort of cocky and complacent again, as they seem to, you know,
yes,
after the convention?
There always is.
Yep.
That complacency is always an issue, and you know, there's a way that people can engage with this kind of race, and it involves you know, getting involved in volunteering and doing that sort of thing. If you know, the pure expressions of joy or despair is not really going to cut it. You're going to have to get out and get involved. I do want to say one thing about Trump and being unprepared. There actually is something that he does seem to be prepared for, and that is all of these sort of right-wing fever swamp tropes that he did bring up on repeated occasion last night. The problem is that no average American actually knows what he's talking about, and so there was this weird sensation that I had. I consider myself pretty well-informed, and I didn't know what he was talking about half the time. When he's talking about very random appearances in front of the AFL-CIO or his support from the Immigration and Customs Enforcement when he actually meant the union of the Border Patrol. You know, there are these things that happen on Fox News and at Breitbart.com that the ordinary American among the 100 million that watched last night just aren't clued into. And he only gave half the story. He didn't give the context at all. So it just sounded even more incoherent than otherwise it might have.
Let me get in one last clip here. This is talking about, well, his claim that she does not have the stamina to be presidential and that she doesn't look presidential.
Earlier this month, you said she doesn't have, quote, a presidential look. She's standing here right now. What did you mean by that?
She doesn't have the look. She doesn't have the stamina. I said she doesn't have the stamina. And I don't believe she does have the stamina. You have so many different things you have to be able to do. And I don't believe that Hillary has the stamina.
Let's let her respond.
As soon as he travels to 112 countries and negotiates a peace deal, a ceasefire, a release of dissidents, an opening of new opportunities in nations around the world, or even spends 11 hours testifying in front of a congressional committee, he can talk to me about stamina.
The world, let me tell you.
Mic drop. Josh Marshall writes that, sure, Donald Trump was bad, but she was at least as good as he was bad. And I got to say, I said earlier, I'm not a big Clinton fan, but she had the weight of the world on her shoulders last night. And I do think that the pressure had to be extraordinary. But so while he failed, she really did also exceed expectations, I think, at the very least. Heather?
Oh, absolutely. You know, she's a professional politician. She's very, very good at what she does. I think she's never gotten enough credit for it. I think there's a lot of, you know, things that go on in that, not the least of which is certain sexist assumptions. And I think she's a pretty darn good politician, to be honest with you. I don't think the first woman, you know, you can't discount her and say that some lousy politician could get to the point where she is and not be pretty good at what she does. And I think that she was coming in there, and it's the stamina question. The sexism is related to him saying she doesn't look like a president. And, you know, they addressed that at the Democratic convention when they showed all the pictures of the president and then, boom, shattered the glass, and there was Hillary on the big screen. That was showing, I think, yes, she doesn't look like any president has ever looked before, because you know, she's a woman and there's never been one. But the stamina question, I think she really did have to answer that last night. Unfortunately, her bout with pneumonia, the coughing, and this concerted attack on the right, which had been going on for at least 6 weeks, probably longer, they'd been setting it up, of her having some problem and her being mentally unstable and not being able to, you know, kind of handle it, and Trump pounding for months and months that she didn't have the strength and the stamina to do it. That was all a plan. That wasn't something that just sort of happened spontaneously. And when she unfortunately tried to fight that and barrel through when she got pneumonia and that video turned up, it was like, I think that is probably what had the biggest effect on her poll numbers in the recent period. To the extent that she lost numbers, I think that was probably the precipitating event. And I think last night she put that to rest. You didn't look at that woman and go, you know, she's weak or she's got a problem or she can't think or, you know, whatever it was, she's got brain damage or whatever it was they were going to say. You know, she was totally in control, not just in control, she was dominating. And I think that when you dominate Donald Trump and you do that in front of 100 million people, I think that's going to have an effect on her. And I think you asked David whether or not the polls are going to bump. I don't have any idea either. But I will say that I would never have expected them to, but I wouldn't be surprised to see an uptick for her just because of what you just said.
Well,
I think that she dominated, and I think that he cratered on such a massive level.
And they were, her poll numbers were cratering. I think at the very least, maybe she staunched the bleeding. I actually think it could turn them around. I thought she was just that good. Anyway, that was Heather Digby Parton. You can find her work, as ever, at Salon.com and at Digby's blog, .blogspot.com, and on the Twitters at Digby56. And David Dayen, you are at D Dayen on the Twitters, also at Salon and Fiscal Times. And your book, which is hopefully doing very well, Chain of Title. What's the subtitle there? I don't have it in front of me all of a sudden, Dave.
Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And for those of you in Southern California, I'm speaking about Chain of Title tomorrow in Westlake Village on Wednesday at a restaurant called Cisco's, which has a room in the back. And that is at 925 South Westlake Boulevard in Westlake Village, California, at 6 o'clock tomorrow.
Smartly done. And check out his Tumblr site, right, where you have all of your appearances coming
up? David Dayen, all one word, .tumblr.com.
Smartly done. All right, we got to get out. We'll be doing this again soon with the vice presidential and two more presidential debates coming up if Donald Trump decides to show up there. My thanks to both Heather Digby Parton and David Dayen. Of course, to my producer, Desi Doyen. Thank you very much for wrestling that to the ground. And you can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free, as ever, at bradblog.com, or drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman with one final thought. We are now less than 1,500 days from the 2020 presidential elections.
Yeah.
There you go. Good luck, world.